Okay, I think we're going to get started. I want to thank everyone for coming today and for braving this weather. I think the drive-in wasn't too bad, but the drive home may not be quite as nice. My name is Erica Hart. For those of you who don't know me, I'm an attorney at the Taunt Law Firm. My bankruptcy practice focuses mostly in consumer Chapter 7s and Chapter 13s. I represented Chuck Taunt as a Chapter 7 trustee during my whole career. I also do Chapter 11 work and creditor work as well. But I also have an estate planning practice, so when we sit here and talk about mental health issues, I see some of the capacity issues from that side as well. I want to introduce the rest of the panel. To my left is Chief Judge Scott Dales, who is our Chief Bankruptcy Judge from the Western District of Michigan. To my right is Dr. Barika Butler. She is a doctor in psychiatry and neurology, and she is the Chief Medical Officer for the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority, among other professional attributes. And then further to my right is Judge Terrence Keith, who is a judge with the Wayne County Probate Court. And although I didn't know you in this capacity, you were a bankruptcy attorney in a former life.
Much of my former life, yes.
Right. So this is actually a topic, mental health issues in bankruptcy, that is near and dear to my heart, and there are a few other planning members who we've talked about this issue for a number of years, and so I'm glad we can have this panel today. As bankruptcy attorneys, we often meet people at the worst time in their life. So their bankruptcy might be accompanied by divorce, by health problems, their own or a loved one's, by job loss, by death of a loved one. And the trauma of then needing to go through a bankruptcy and the financial problems that come with that can either influence or exacerbate or even trigger mental health issues that we are going to discuss. So things such as depression, anxiety. And so how do we as practitioners recognize those issues? How do we address those issues? When we look at Chapter 7 cases in particular, but Chapter 13s as well, from a debtor side, the fees are not super high per case. So then to spend additional time dealing with mental health issues may not be compensated. So how do we address that? But we have an enormous opportunity to meet these clients where they are with compassion and understanding and to make a meaningful difference in their experience. So the way we address clients who are going through these situations, in addition, if they have mental health issues, can make a really meaningful difference in their experience and a meaningful difference in our experience as well. If we can recognize that these issues exist, we may be able to move through the process a lot more quickly. So we want to focus on mental health issues and how they impact and are impacted by bankruptcy, but I think we should first discuss our duty as professionals to our clients with mental health issues. And I just want to say to anyone who has, I think we can probably all think of some war stories that we have with particular clients that come to mind with mental health issues as we sit here. I could probably talk for the entire time about that. But I'm not going to. So we're going to reserve some time at the end to let everyone share some stories. But if you do have questions as we go along, we always encourage people to participate. So with that, I'm going to ask Judge Dales to talk a little bit about the Michigan Rule of Professional Conduct 1.14. This is in your materials that actually addresses our duty as attorneys to represent clients who have a disability.
Well, good morning, everybody. Putting aside your own obvious neuroses, how many of you have experienced in your professional life representing somebody who was incapacitated to some or considerable extent? Mm-hmm. Just about everybody. Is that why everybody's here? Okay, great. And how many of you are willing to share those stories? Just one? Couple of them. Okay. Because I think it'll be helpful to flesh things out if throughout the program you volunteer your own experience. I think that'll put some meat on the bones. How many people were aware that there's a model or Michigan rule of professional conduct that addresses a lawyer's relationship with an incapacitated client? Two, three, not many. It's a really short rule. At first glance, it's kind of hard to understand, and I think if we go through it a little bit, maybe we'll have a sense of what the rule is trying to accomplish. The text of the rule, it's really short, as I said, and here it is. When a client's ability to make adequately considered decisions in connection with the representation is impaired, whether because of minority or mental disability or for some other reason, the lawyer shall, as far as reasonably possible, maintain a normal client-lawyer relationship with the client. That's the gist of the rule. The second part of the rule, it says, a lawyer may seek the appointment of a guardian or take other protective action with respect to a client only when the lawyer reasonably believes that the client cannot adequately act in the client's own interest. That's the entire guts of the rule. Nothing else. So the focus of the rule is on maintaining a normal client relationship. Who's ever had a normal client relationship? And that's part of the problem, right? But I think what the drafters of the rule were getting at is that I think they recognize that we have a tendency when dealing with people who suffer in one way or another from incapacity. We're not going to talk about minority so much here, but we may have some of that in our practice from time to time. I think it's fair to say that some of the discussion of some of the cases dealing with underage clients can also have some bearing on dealing with the mentally incapacitated. But I think what I'd like to do is maybe just remind us of what a normal client relationship is and how we might be quick to depart from that when we're representing the incapacitated. So a couple things. A normal client relationship requires competence on the part of the lawyer. Now, what do you think that means? Obviously, competence in terms of the subject matter. They came to you for bankruptcy assistance or to help get somebody evicted or something along those lines. You got to be knowledgeable in the subject matter. But Rule 2.1 of the Michigan Rules of Professional Conduct, which actually is another rule probably often neglected, addresses the lawyer's role as counselor and says that the lawyer should be prepared to counsel the client on matters other than the law when it comes into contact with the professional representation. So competence may be an ability to deal with an incapacitated client, to know how to communicate, for example, which is another hallmark of the normal attorney-client relationship. Communication with your clients it's expressed in the preamble to the rules. It's throughout the whole, it's infused in the whole nature of the attorney-client relationship that you're going to keep your client informed, your client's going to make informed decisions. Some of those things go by the wayside if your client is incapacitated, depending on the consent of the incapacity. Another hallmark of the attorney-client relation that we have to be respectful of is zealous advocacy. In your normal client relationships, your client wants to do something that you don't necessarily agree with. What do? You do it. If it's not unlawful. Now, somebody wanted to withdraw. Who wants to withdraw? Wow. No fortitude. What you do if you're representing the client, if what they're asking for is lawful and not immoral or otherwise criminal or whatever, as a zealous advocate, you're supposed to advocate for your client.
Right. They want to keep the house, but they really can't afford it. Right?
Right.
That's then you file an objection to the motion to lift stay. Right? Those types of things.
I think with Rule 1.14, it recognizes the human tendency for the lawyer to want to substitute his or her own judgment for the wishes of the client. And I think the main point of 1.14 is to say that just because your client may be incapacitated to some extent or completely, your client to the extent that, that he or she can understand what's going on in connection with representation, has autonomy and doesn't forfeit the autonomy just because he or she is incapacitated. I think the autonomy of the client and the nature of the attorney-client relationship as an agency relationship is a large part of what Rule 1.14 is trying to accomplish, trying to remind us that the client is the principal and we are the agent. All right. The other aspect of the attorney-client relationship, a hallmark that is implicated when we're representing incapacitated persons, is the duty of confidentiality. Well, how does that come in? It comes in a couple of ways, I think, and maybe you've had some experience in some of the folks in this room, with someone coming to you on behalf of somebody else, like a son or a daughter coming in, or maybe the client coming in with a good friend who's just there to help out. Our natural tendency is to talk to these folks that come along with the client, and I'm not telling you not to do that, but I'm suggesting that the rule reminds us that even if your client is incapacitated, you have a duty to protect client confidences and client communications. And there's a risk of inviting other people into the room. There's a risk of waiver. Does that make sense? So one of the hallmarks that we can all readily think of in the attorney-client relationship is confidentiality. We might be quick to throw that by the wayside if we're not reminded in Rule 1.14 that we have to be careful.
And I think, you know, we talk here, as Judge Dales is talking about, incapacity, right? And I think it would be great if we, if that were black and white, if we could really define that easily. But we're not just talking about someone who is incapacitated when we talk about mental health issues, right? And so as we prepared for this panel and in talking with Dr. Butler about how she, as a psychiatrist and medical professional, how she looks at identifying not just capacity, but mental health issues. It was an interesting conversation because you had you were saying that in, when you provide competency evaluations, that they're very specific.
They're very specific. And again, good morning. Thank you for addressing this topic. I usually try to stay very far away from lawyers and judges. So this is my own anxiety here, but I feel like this is a safe space. So yes, when we evaluate capacity, we are able to do that as medical professionals and specifically as psychiatrists. And what happens generally is our colleagues will call on us to assess someone who more than likely is in the hospital and facing a very serious decision that they have to make, whether it be about life-sustaining issues or medications or whatever that health issue may be. And we're able to do that under our medical license to assess for capacity, which has to be a very specific question. And even most physicians don't really understand that. So I may be called to assess someone to see if they can withdraw care. But the reality is I need a very specific question to assess for capacity. Is this patient able to make this very specific decision on this date about this specific thing? And the more specific, the better. The better my assessment can be and the better I can give an answer as far as how the other treating physicians or family should probably proceed, which differs, as you all know better than I do, from a competency evaluation, which is a legal issue. And those two things are often, they have some gray areas, and there is some crossover, especially when you start talking about forensic psychiatry. But it is imperative that we as co-professionals understand those differences and those nuances so that we can work together to ensure that your clients, as they're going through bankruptcy or other legal or medical issues, are represented well and that those decisions are made appropriately. So there are some gray areas, but very specific in that line between competency, which is your lane, and capacity, which would fall more into my lane.
And so when we talk about the clients that show up at our doorstep and their capacity or their competence Most of those people are not going to have had a conservator or a guardian appointed over them. And we'll get to that in just a second with Judge Keith. You can help us, everyone in the room, understand those kind of terms of art. So most people are not going to have that type of formal representation, and they'll be somewhere on a spectrum, right, of their ability to understand their finances, their ability to understand what their assets are, and the ability to cope with the process. So when we talk about depression or anxiety, and I think Judge Dale said this when we were talking in preparing for this, that very frequently it's easy in this context to confuse the symptoms of depression and anxiety with someone who's irresponsible. So we see these things as a character flaw, right? That debtors very, very frequently, how many people have had a hard time chasing down documents from a debtor, right? Everybody's both hands need to go up. We see that as a character flaw, right? But is that really a character flaw? How do we decipher between the people who simply just can't get their act together, or who have a hard time doing that, and the people who have a mental illness that makes it a challenge to go through this process?
So what I would recommend is that you really have a low threshold of suspicion, and that you, as you stated earlier, advocate for your client at that point, and try to keep in mind that this is, as you stated, a very stressful situation, and all of us respond to stress in different ways, but some people's is to fall back, become disorganized, but also looking at the persistence of this behavior. So the more that you get to know your client, is this the way this patient or this person behaves outside of this situation? Is this persistent across different areas of their lives? Are work, health, family issues also being approached in the same way? And are they presenting in the same fashion? Or is this stressor, in fact, causing this issue? I think it's important to look at that temporally, as far as getting a little bit of an idea, and not at all do we as medical professionals want you to do any diagnosing. We just recommend that you have a very low threshold to send them to us so that we can do the diagnosing. But temporally, did this person perhaps present with these symptoms, or were they always this disorganized and then bankruptcy happened, or did bankruptcy happen and this person became pretty disorganized and start to have other symptoms that you were concerned about?
If I can touch on a couple points that Dr. Butler's just raised. The difference between, I would say, the medical diagnosis of mental illness and the court's determination of mental illness. The definition of mental illness by the probate court under 330.14.00, I think it's C or G, is that there must be a finding of substantial disorder of thought or mood that significantly impairs the judgment or the behavior. That's the information we have to find by clear and convincing evidence. The way of getting there in terms of a client coming to you and having, as Dr. Butler says, the finding a low threshold, is to recognize that 1.14B allows for you to bring in other people, other professionals, doctors, if you will, to help make that determination. And to that extent, the issue, the concern that judge raises about attorney-client privilege arises significantly. So you have a dance to make, if you will, between your legal representation of your client, having a professional make the evaluation, and to what extent that, if you're going to look for a court order, the court making a determination that there is a finding of mental illness. But that's two separate parts and really carries over to the latter part of our discussion about discharge bill and some other issues.
And I... Oh, did you?
Go ahead.
I actually was really... I was happy to see that the panel prior was taking some action or suggesting at least some way to let the court know about a mental illness that might affect the debtor, but do so in a in a protected manner. Because and we can talk about that as we talk through bankruptcy specific issues a little bit more. But that was definitely a concern. Is how do you, if you need to put on the record somewhere, it may be a different issue. I'm sure it's not a different issue actually in the probate court, because just because somebody has a mental illness now doesn't mean that they won't, or that they'll have that for the rest of their lives, right? And now you're correct. Making a public record about someone's not just capacity, but their ability to cope in the world. And I think that there's a lot of concern as we move forward about this digital world and what's accessible for future employers or future legal issues and moving forward.
Well, the thing that comes to mind is someone out there, their immediate response to the judge's question was to withdraw. And I guess the question is, what are the initial steps that the attorney should take when he or she over the part of the low threshold to, quote, cover him or herself, given the complexities of the situation?
I think there's some guidance in the commentary to Rule 1.14 in recognizing that lawyers are not medical professionals, not diagnosticians. Mm-hmm. And the comments to the rule suggest a couple of things before taking the somewhat extraordinary step of inviting someone else to the party to evaluate your client. And they ask, the rules, the drafters of the rules suggest that you consider the ability of your client to articulate a rationale or reasoning for a particular decision. Not just articulate the decision, but the reasons for the decision. That you seek to understand the variability of the state of mind of your client. And when I say that, I think you made the point that these problems of capacity or understanding may come and go. Mm-hmm. I had experience with my mother-in-law, 93 years old, so 3 years ago when she was much younger. She was acting crazy. I mean, she looked like King Lear at the Heath, raging against the wind. We got a call from her caregiver, better get up to Grand Rapids, and, you know, this is it. Your mother-in-law is destined for the dustbin, basically. We took her to the hospital. They gave her penicillin, and they treated her bladder infection. And they told us that in elderly people, bladder infections present as delusions and dementia. How many of you knew that? Those with older parents, right? So my mother-in-law went from King Lear to, I'm not that literary, but basically she was restored to her normal self. The next day she had a bow in her hair and her hideous brooch, and she was ready to go. So I think that's what we're talking about with variability. So look at it over time. And one last point from and I'll give up the podium here. Consider the substantive fairness of the decision or the outcome that your client is asking for, and whether it's consistent, if this is a long-term client or if you have access to your client's past, whether this behavior or this decision is consistent with your client's values as you understand them or know them. And those are the kind of the quick and dirty things that the comments suggest that you look at before, I think, inviting someone else in to scrutinize your client. And then the other point I'd make, and it's not if it's in the comments, I didn't see it, but document this for yourself. Document your views as to why it is that you're inviting someone in, whether it's inviting the son or daughter in to talk about the mother's issues, or inviting a friend in, or inviting a professional in. Document it.
Well, and I think this is tricky in bankruptcy, right? Because we have, I don't know if it is the shortest relationship with our clients in all of law, but it feels like it, right? It's so short as debtor's counsel, unless you do chapter 13 work and then you're really stuck with them for a really long time. The Chapter 7s are so quick, and so you meet with them once, maybe twice in your office, maybe your paralegal does a lot of that communication, and then you meet with them at the 341. You meet with them once, they come in to sign, you meet with them at the 341, and then hopefully the rest of everything else goes smoothly. And so how do we, and then with the cost to file, how do we have the ability to put this time and effort into making sure we're addressing mental health issues when we need to keep the cost low, because our clients really can't afford the fees that would be required for us to spend the time it really takes to address these issues. So I feel like we're meeting these clients in their worst of place without the ability to take the time to really look at it. So we need to be able to make a quick assessment of what are their circumstances. Do they have some anxiety, depression, bipolar, other mental health issues that we can, to your point, Dr. Butler, a low threshold of suspicion to identify and say, this could impact my case. And is this going to impact their ability to sign schedules, their ability to appear at a 341? Are they, do they have student loans? Could they be dischargeable because of their circumstances?
I'm curious as to the experiences that people in the room have had in terms of when did it arise? Did it arise when you had the initial interview? Did it arise at the 341 hearing, at the document request, when there was a creditor objection? When did the bell start going off and it says, well, you call somebody, what do I do? Anybody have a sense?
So
yeah, Ethan.
I would just say, what happened when you see the decline? So you say the relationship is very short, but in the period of 4 months where you can see that person making decisions that are different, they don't want you talking about their case, their paranoia that starts coming up, all those things, and you're saying, okay, well, what do I do in this situation? Are they making competent decisions about their case moving forward? Or am I so close to the end, let me just try to get to the end and allow this case to complete, that I've done my job and I'm finished with it. So I just, from an ethical perspective,
I think that's a great point, right? It creates a dilemma as a bankruptcy attorney that you are not likely to get paid anything extra, right? At this point, if you're providing basic services, you recognize it. Either there's a decline during that 4 months, or you only recognize it because of circumstances, right? There are assets that weren't disclosed, and those come up at the 341. And then the trustee requests documents to discuss, to investigate those assets. And you think, okay, 2 weeks seems like a reasonable period for my client to produce those documents, and they just can't do it. They can't communicate. They're not responding to you, or they're responding, but it's scattered. How do you get them to the end? Because that's really the best thing for them, right, is to get a discharge and move forward and just be done with the trustee. How do you get them there?
I think one of the points that you made when we were discussing this in preparation for today was, and you came close to making it just now, if you see your client having these sorts of problems, adjust your response to, for example, the trustee's demand for documents. If you think anybody ought to be able to get documents together in 2 weeks, before you commit your client to get documents together in 2 weeks, maybe you should slow the process down, right? Because if you commit your client to get the documents in 2 weeks and then their documents aren't in, and then there's a court order or a turnover order, and before you know it, because you didn't adjust your approach to this person, you end up laying the groundwork for denying the relief that they're after to begin with.
Right. And I mean, the consequence of having a 727 complaint, right, from a trustee because they failed to cooperate with an order to produce documents is, I mean, that's even more devastation to than their denied, you know, have their discharge denied, the whole goal of this process, that's even more devastation laid on someone who may have may already have some mental health issues.
And I don't know what the nuances are of your ability to do this from your professional perspective, but if that person has any kinds of social resources, supports, and being able to engage those, I think this could be a really important time to try to do that, because you have limited time, you yourself have limited resources, and you're kind of trying to go off whatever they're giving you. And sometimes getting some of that collateral information and assistance could be really helpful.
Yeah.
I would just say, in response to what Judge Dale was mentioning, that yes, we definitely should, and certainly when I have clients that have emotional issues or mental problems, whether diagnosed or not, we always do. I would say the hardest problem that I run into in those is often not the client, but the trustee that we're having to deal with. Because it can vary so wildly. I mean, I know if I get one trustee, they'll be great. And we've talked about it. I'll call them up beforehand and explain, you know, this is what's going on, keep you gentle. And then I know there's one trustee in particular. If I get them, I have to prep the client, because there's a good chance they might end up in tears before it's done. And I end up having to fight with the trustee to do it. And I think we could get more cooperation with the trustees and the court. That's great, because we will certainly tailor our practices. But if we're not getting it tailored on the other side as well, it's not really going to help anyone.
Hmm. Right.
This point. I would say there may be something in Ethan to respect, in response to Ethan's hypothetical. Of watching somebody decline over the course of even a short representation. A couple things that come to mind about the onset of the representation. And one of them is that when we talk about the various abilities or various, the continuum or the spectrum of incapacity, right? They can understand some things, but the larger transactions are more complicated. They couldn't understand and that sort of thing. The law makes distinctions between capacity to contract, capacity like testamentary capacity, donative capacity, capacity to sign deeds and all that. The contractual capacity is actually implicated when you are entering into your retainer agreement to begin with. And you have to make sure that your client has the capacity to enter into the retainer agreement. So this is not, and you'll see this in some, I've read a fair amount of literature in the last, you know, month or two on this stuff. You see a recurring theme about the capacity on the front end. And then as long as we're talking about the front end of the transaction, I think this is where it might be responsive to Ethan's point. I don't think it would be such a bad thing to put in your retainer agreement, or consider putting in your retainer agreement if you have some concerns, for the contingency that somebody may need you to reach out to their helpline or their lifeline at some point during the representation. And that it almost like a healthcare proxy for lawyers, right, to bake into your retainer agreement for individuals. Listen, this representation can be stressful, and throughout the course of it, I may see signs of stress, and it may be helpful for me to reach out to your, and the client can designate who it would be, and authorize you to reach out to the daughter or to the son or to the spouse or to whatever the situation may be, in consultation with the client, obviously, because the client autonomy, right? You know, if the client doesn't want you reaching out to the son, I don't want you talking to that ne'er-do-well, whatever, you got to respect that.
But that's a good point, because I think that comes up almost always from, in my view, from the very first meeting, right? They come with that son. They come with the, you know, mom. They come with that party.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, you can go ahead and meet. I mean, when I take them in the reception room, I say, oh, you know, who's this person? And they'll introduce them. And I kiddingly refer to them as a bodyguard. They're there to protect the interest of that person. And sometimes you throw so much legal jargon out without trying to do it, it almost takes two people to understand what one attorney said, and hopefully they can take that home. But I immediately bring up, I said, if you want that person in on this conference, you're more than welcome to, but I have to inform you, you're waiving attorney-client privilege. And I talked to them right from the get-go about that. And without a fail, 100% of them say, no, I want that person in the room, because they can't cope sometimes without that support person in that conference.
And I would say, in response to that, Marty, I think it's wise to raise the question of privilege. I've been saying that's part of the hallmark of the normal client relationship, right? It's a privilege. But including people that may be necessary for the communication doesn't necessarily waive the privilege. So you want to keep that in mind. And that's why I say, if you're going to have someone in the room with your client and you think that person is necessary to help your client understand the complexity of bankruptcy, and let's face it, it's pretty complex, document that.
You know, part of when the questions comes up, when we talk about having the, you know, the other person in the room, is that your client who's looking to file bankruptcy may in fact have their legal guardian there. And to the extent that they have the legal capacity to sign that contract, because under a guardianship, if there's been an order for guardianship, there's a determination that he or she lacks the ability to contract because of some level of incapacity. So it may be necessary, one, to figure out if he or she has a guardian and whether or not they do have the authority to enter into that retainer agreement. Separately, if the individual has a conservator, because it is a conservator versus a guardian who has the authority to make decisions about their financial assets. Now, those are two items apart from mental illness issues. But when you start talking about who has the ability, if you have concerns that someone's infirm or there's some other issues going on, that's one of the questions you may want to ask. Because I've had a couple cases where there is a petition for conservatorship that says, oh, by the way, that they have a Chapter 13 going on. Oh, by the way, they filed bankruptcy at such a different period of time. There's a couple other questions out there.
Right.
In an informal way. And as a trustee, that's the problem that we see. So if you could speak to that a little bit, I'd appreciate
it. I think that in one way to resolve this issue is a power of attorney. Right, a power of attorney document. So we can go all the way from having a family or friend, family member or friend who's in the room and is helpful, right, all the way to a guardian or conservator, which is a legal determination combined with a medical determination, right? But there's an in-between, which is a power of attorney. There are two types of powers of attorney, and one is effective upon execution, right, when it's signed, and one is effective when a person becomes disabled. It's called a springing power of attorney. More and more, we like to see the ones that are effective on execution because, frankly, if you're going to trust someone to be responsible with your finances and your circumstances, if you're incapacitated, then you should be able to trust them right now, right? But so if there are powers of attorney, that's something you can ask for and say, do you have a power of attorney? Most often, it's going to be that daughter or son or spouse or whoever is there anyway. If they have the capacity to sign a power of attorney at that time, they just simply need someone else to deal with it, right? But they have the capacity to understand that they are asking another family member to help them. They might be able to sign a very simple power of attorney to say, you are my representative, you can sign these documents, you can go forward. You need to watch out for that and make sure they could have capacity. But that's a question to ask. It might be a simple fix.
And before we get to the next question, to fortify that, Rule 9010, the federal bankruptcy procedure, contemplates that entities, including debtors, can perform any act not constituting the practice of law through an agent. So that may be a way of using the existing rules. I appreciate that the commission is trying to change things, and I think that's a step in the right direction. That's going to take a long time. So we got to look at some of our existing devices to see how it may help us. And if you take a peek at Rule 9010, you might be surprised to see that acts not constituting the practice of law can be performed by an agent or proxy expressly under the rules. So maybe that'll help.
We had a question. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So this was kind of an interesting situation. We had a mentally incapacitated client. kind of third party and you try desperately to get her into the office to sign like a DOA and you know all this other stuff you can really do it in case I end up failing. And you know, in those situations where you're like you've got the third party who claims to be like responsible party, but they're not actually the responsible party. You know, at what point and where do you think about like I don't know. I was like close to calling to contact Adult Protective Services. I don't know where that duty begins. I don't know where it ends. I don't know if there's, you know, some of these clients, you know, they're just so, depending on where you practice, maybe not where you practice so much, but anywhere in this field, you're going to run into something like that. And, you know, refer this over to the probate court for emergency guardianship or something like that.
Well, I think I'm going to let Judge Keith talk about, you know, his understanding of maybe duties to act in that circumstance. But there is a difference between a duty to act and the ability to act, right?
There is the if you feel the circumstances are so egregious, so appalling, you can't call Adult Protective Services. Excuse me, and have them come out and meet with that individual at his or her home, and they can bring the petition for guardianship or, if need be, seek a petition for mental health treatment order, an involuntary mental health treatment order. But you have the ability to make that inquiry on your own if that is something that, from all the information you've gathered, is a genuine concern. Call Adult Protective Services and let them do the initial investigation, let them make the determination, let them initiate the petition with the probate court.
And your question was, at what point do you do that? And I think that is that's what Rule 1.14B is trying to answer. And it says, you may seek the appointment of a guardian or take other protective action. So what Judge Keith is suggesting is other protective action may be calling Adult Protective Services. With respect to the client, only when the lawyer reasonably believes that the client cannot adequately act in the client's own interest. So in the rules, professional conduct, they define reasonably in relation to the conduct by a lawyer as denoting the conduct of a reasonably prudent and competent lawyer. So if you got to the point where you think this person cannot act, and again, if you document it for your own, to cover your own tail, and then I think Rule 1.14B is telling you when it's okay for you to take steps, not necessarily to file the guardianship or conservatorship petition yourself, but maybe the intermediate step, as the judge recommended, of contacting Adult Protective Services, something along those lines.
Or if there's a family member that you've had contact with, okay, in the course of who's familiar with the situation, they can make the determination if they want to initiate that proceeding. Okay. So there's someone else to do. Just ahead of you. Yes, had a question.
I was going to say, I did have some, I think maybe 30% of my clients have mental problems. Seriously. I've done criminal law and probate, but I don't understand why people cry in bankruptcy court, but I have people crying in bankruptcy court.
Yes.
The trustee wants to take their house.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they have an emotional attachment here that, for the family reason, and I don't think that that's a serious mental illness, but it is a client issue that sometimes I can't save their house for them. But I did have an elderly lady, because this was a Chapter 13 case, who came to see me, and she came with someone who was driving her. She couldn't drive a car. She had a house, a very nice house that was paid for. But she did tell me initially, when we started the case, that she had two adult sons living in the house with her. One was developmentally disabled. The other one had some other kind of mental disability. They were both getting Social Security. So you have to make a disclosure in the bankruptcy court that there are these other streams of income coming into the house.
Right.
And so I did realize that there was a potential issue there. But as the case progressed, she would call me very sweetly and say she couldn't pay her property taxes, she couldn't do this and she couldn't do that. And because only the pre-petition property taxes were included in her plan, she got a default on her property taxes And I realized that she was incapacitated and could not get down there to pay her, to meet with the Wayne County Treasurer. So I actually considered that maybe I should contact the probate court and ask for a protective order just to prevent the foreclosure. But then when I started asking her why doesn't she have money, because she had a pension and Social Security, she said, well, my son gets my debit card and he buys things on it.
Oh, and then we've got an elder abuse situation, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, we could spend like 2 hours talking just about that.
So I did call the
services. Okay.
And I had to get her out of the house with these two sons, which meant I had to get a neighbor to bring her to my office and call the daughter out of state to meet with protective services. Got to meet a lot of legal work before which I can't get compensated.
Right.
And the bankruptcy court, it's just one of those situations where over the years I noticed that she was mentally deteriorating.
Right.
And I no longer cope with this situation, which is usually we go through bankruptcy court so fast in Chapter 7, just you don't see it. Yeah, until it's too late.
And that's an important point that you bring up about the family stressors. And what happens is, because we know that psychiatric illness is biological in nature, is that we often see this as a multi-generational issue, which you end up with, you know, the children or the parents and multiple stressors there. I would encourage, and, you know, even taking the next step in a less maybe more kind of suggestive way of helping people and saying, would it be helpful if you think you went and talked to someone? Or would it be helpful if I helped you find some resources to do X, Y, or Z? Even if it's not specific to your particular case, but still advocating for the person that's sitting across from you, who I would imagine with a client with your profession, that you built trusted relationships with the people sitting across from you, and that they may take your word or suggestion to speak with someone or get help from another professional in the mental health realm in a different way than they may from other people outside of that, because they trust you. So I would just encourage that, even if it's not a very specific plan that you're needing for your case per se, but to consider making those suggestions and recommendations and sharing those resources so that they can get the help, even if it's after you're done with your case.
You know, no one wants to ever fully acknowledge that their level of depression has gotten to the point where they become dysfunctional. Okay, I see it quite often. I'm sure Dr. Butler sees it quite often. And it certainly would arise in a bankruptcy context that if you're a certain generation, filing bankruptcy is the moral equivalent of the immortal sin, that you are not able to pay your debts and you have walked away from everybody. And there's a shame, there's a scarlet letter attached to it. So it can arise in the midst of doing the transaction to the point where you can't get the documents, you can't get the information, and you know, the Chapter 13 and or the 11 just falls apart. Yes?
Can you talk about the tensions that would be involved in, with client consent, disclosing a mental health condition in their bankruptcy petitioner schedules? For example, you might have a person who has racked up an immense amount of credit card charges in the 90 days before the petition.
Right.
You know, creditor might look at this and say, well, this is egregious retail therapy. On the other hand, the person might have obsessive compulsive disorder or be bipolar. And so, you know, those things might benefit their case insofar as allowing them to keep their discharge.
Right.
So can you talk about that? Because you would be creating a permanent record, and it is public, of their mental illness.
I think that's an interesting issue, and I have a client who we've been delaying his bankruptcy filing for literally exactly that reason. He's high and low, and he's actually very, I've been very lucky to have a couple of clients who have been willing to be very open about their mental illnesses with me and their depression and anxieties, and talk about the way that it affects their ability to get me documents or respond to things that I need. So I feel like being able to look behind that a little bit is helpful. So he says very openly, I did this, and I know you told me I'm not supposed to buy luxury items within 90 days. I'm sorry. What do we do? But, you know, how do we deal with this? And we wait and we hope that it works out. But but go ahead.
No, I was going to say, bear in mind that the mere fact that someone may have the mental illness does not make them dysfunctional in of itself, that they cannot have a normal life. There are a zillion people in this world who have mental illnesses with the right medication and regular taking the medication do wonderfully well. What can happen, however, is that people start thinking that they don't need to take the medication anymore, that you know, I'm cured, and they fall off. And to what extent, this was part of the discussion we had on the conference call, and the thing that stays with me is, so you know, you have a 13, you know, and you have a client who has a mental illness, but he or she's been taking their medication for all the time, and all the time. But something happens, there's a trigger, and they shut down, they stop taking their medication. And this chapter 13 that's been going flawlessly for, you know, 24 months, suddenly they default. Okay, what happens? How do you handle that? Or in the case of you're talking about retail fraud, you know, at the time they got the contract, they were fine. Okay, they're making their regular payments. But something happened, and they defaulted on their payments. How does that relate to a 523 dischargeability issue?
And I think from an evidentiary standpoint, right, I think how do you put that into the record? How do you have those discussions without it sticking with that person forever, right? I think that we are blessed to have a great group of judges who, if that issue was brought to the judge, would be willing and able to kind of work through a way to seal that record if that were necessary. Perhaps a compassionate opposing counsel. If you said, listen, I think this is why this happened, and I'm really worried. You know, I want to have this conversation. I want to talk about what happened in these expenditures, but there's a history here, or we can show that, you know, why this might have happened. But from an evidentiary standpoint, so let's assume that we can seal the record in some way, right, and protect that. I think that might be an easier way to deal with that.
Well, excuse me for interjecting.
No, please.
Let's suppose they have had a long history of mental illness treatment, and there are treatment orders in the probate court record.
Right.
Okay, that's open there, but it has not been disclosed as part of the bankruptcy.
Right. Well, there's another sort of middle ground. I'm always trying to find a middle ground, right? And sealing is one thing. But the bigger concern these days with the information about someone's mental illness is the fact that the court records are publicly accessible remotely and electronically.
Hmm.
And the court could limit remote electronic access to particular parts of the record without sealing the record. And I know in my life I've had a number of instances where I am really sort of anathema to sealing the record unless it's absolutely something that I have to do, because I have this antiquated notion about the, you know, government and the sunshine. It's quaint, I know. But I can still have a public record and yet limit what is really the problem, which is remote electronic access, with an order. So I think that's something to consider in the context of the problems that you're describing, of concerns about the stigma that we still have with mental illness.
And I think there's a twofold issue. Thank you. First, thank you for sharing that, because I had no idea that you could do that. So that's an interesting intermediate position.
The Wizard of Oz.
The Wizard of Oz, right? So that could be helpful. But then there's the evidentiary issue, right? So your client has these highs and lows. They have purchases. Maybe from a student loan dischargeability standpoint, a client suffers from depression and really cannot be employable going forward in some meaningful way. And let's assume we can have the record protected in some way. What evidence is necessary in order to demonstrate that for these adversary proceedings? If we're talking about a credit card and there were all these purchases made, does there have to be a history of highs and lows of purchases? Do you need medical records? Right? What kind of documentation do we need? And then the same is true for student loan dischargeability. What kind of medical documentation do you need in order to show that there's an inability to work, make meaningful some kind of meaningful commitment to this going forward. And there are some cases in the materials that go into this as far as, do you need an expert, right? Because now we're in bankruptcy here. This person probably isn't working because we're trying to discharge these student loans, or is working minimally, and they don't have the ability to pay a doctor the rate they should be paid to appear as expert counsel, right, or as an expert witness.
In the spirit of looking to our existing rules as possible solutions, what you're really talking about is the expense of expert testimony. And the federal rules of evidence, which apply in our world, right, include Rule 706 in the Federal Rules of Evidence for court-appointed expert witnesses on the motion of the party or on the court's own initiative. Rule 706. And the rule also says that the cost will be borne by the parties. So there's a way of spreading the cost of expert witness, if you can get the court to go for it, by invoking an existing mechanism under Rule 706 if you're in the situation of an evidentiary hearing of some kind. I would also say a little more broadly, and I think we may be running out of time, and I did want to get this out there because I had my intern running down a rabbit hole all week trying to figure out how do we pay for this stuff. And believe it or not, he made it here, so thank you for coming. And that is the ability to tax some of these costs associated with guardian or conservator or guardian ad litem, or we haven't really talked about the guardian ad litem, but some of these costs to be taxed either as a cost against or in favor of the prevailing party under a couple of court rules, which I'll mention in a second, or by borrowing from the state practice. And Judge Keith and I had a conversation this week about, well, how do you guys pay for it? And you said, well, if there's an estate, we tax the estate.
Right.
Well, similarly, coming across some of the materials and getting ready for today, the bankruptcy court in the District of Massachusetts in February came out with a program for, believe it or not, a panel of guardians ad litem. And the announcement itself, which I guess is in the nature of a general order, says that the cost of the guardian ad litem will be taxed as an administrative expense on notice to, obviously, parties and, with a court order. The language in that administrative order is literally verbatim from a Northern District of Georgia case where a judge in Northern Georgia appointed a guardian ad litem and said the cost of the guardian ad litem will be taxed as administrative expense. Now, I'm not sure that's going to fly everywhere or anywhere unless you want to file, change of venue, get down to Georgia quick. But I will say that if you think about what a guardian ad litem is in our circuit, and a guardian ad litem is not the same thing as a general guardian or a conservator, right? A guardian ad litem or ad litem, you say tomato, I say tomato. I'm not sure which is right. Is appointed in a particular context, in a particular proceeding, and is really designed under Rule 17 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which are baked into our practice, right? This is, again, look at the rules. If you look at Rule 9014, first of all, if you look at Rule 7017, it includes Rule 17 into our adversary proceedings. If you look at Rule 9014C, it includes Rule 7017 and therefore Rule 17 into contested matters. Rule 17 is the rule from the real courts, from the district court, that authorizes the appointment of guardian ad litem. We also have a bankruptcy-specific guardian ad litem, recognition of guardian ad litem, in Rule 1004.1. But my point is, by borrowing from analogy from Rule 17 in the United States District Courts, they have, on occasion, authorized the taxing of the cost of the guardian ad litem as a cost under Rule 54, which also applies in contested matters and adversary proceedings. And my point is, get creative and look at the existing rules and see if you can't find a way to shift the expense to some extent. The other point I'd make is that under the Sixth Circuit precedent, the guardian ad litem is really to help the court ensure due process in the proceeding, which makes it a lot stronger case for tacking it on as a cost of administration than what you might naturally think. Well, the guardian ad litem is there to represent the debtor. We're not going to cost, we're going to have the other, the creditors pay the cost of representing the debtor. Don't assume that's the case. It may not be. I can't say. I'm just discovering it for the first time and preparing for this panel. But there are ways out there, if you look at the existing rules and you look at the rationale of the existing rules, there may be ways to shift the expense either to the estate entirely under 503B and by analogy to the Northern District of Georgia and Massachusetts, or into your adversary if you're the prevailing party in a contested matter or an adversary proceeding. Does that make sense?
I think that, you know, we, in thinking about our bankruptcy clients and these cases, we only have so much in resources. We only have so much time and money that we can put into each one of these cases, right? But a little bit of thinking ahead about our client issues and identifying mental health issues, we may be able to, if we can recognize them, even if all we do is recognize that they exist in this case, it may help us provide a more smooth case for our clients going forward, recognizing that we need to give them more time to provide documents and negotiating with a trustee or negotiating with a creditor, that we might need to physically have them come in. We talked about this on the phone. I had a client who I would send an email, and I try and draft emails in a courteous, you know, always a courteous fashion, but sometimes they're very short and to the point. And I had a client who every time I sent an email, it would be, you know, three pages back. And he was one of my clients who admitted that he suffered with depression. And he just said, every time you do that, like, we need to talk. I can't just get an email in the middle of the day. It just would send him, it would just send him on like a wildfire. It was a wildfire for his brain. He just couldn't handle it. So I learned that that didn't work, right? I thought I was saving time. I'm just going to shoot him off an email, get that done, move on to the next thing today. And it was a wildfire. So some of those things, if you can recognize those things, then I know I'm better off having a 10-minute phone call. Maybe I'm in the car driving back from court, give them a call, and I will accomplish way more there and have a much smoother a case going forward with this client than if I just shoot off an email.
Which is a matter of your own competency in the representation, all of you. If you've got 30% of your clients who have issues, in order to competently represent them, you got to be able to understand how to communicate with them and how to take care of these other aspects of the normal client-attorney-client relationship, so that the normal attorney-client relationship isn't just, I do the work and I get stiffed.
We wanted to reserve some time. We have about 10 minutes left for people to share stories. But before I do that, did anyone else on the panel have anything that we talked about that they really wanted?
I would like to say one thing that we didn't talk about, and it's kind of off topic, but I hope this is okay. As many of you probably know, between our two professions as doctors and lawyers, we tend to end up at the top end of the scale for depression and suicide. So as we have this conversation about clients and how to recognize their own mental health issues, I just wanted to put a plug out there for you to do some self-care and monitor for your own as well.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. That's very important.
Could you talk quickly about HIPAA laws and how that plays into all this, if at all? Because obviously it's privileged health information, and maybe disclosing that to the court could violate HIPAA in some way.
Wow, we didn't talk about that at all.
No, the answer to that is no.
No, yeah. We're not prepared for that conversation.
I don't know the answer. My assumption would be that HIPAA is a constraint on the medical professionals and not necessarily on the folks in the legal community. I'm not certain.
My impression was it could apply to attorneys if there's attorney-client privilege, but I'm not certain either.
Yes.
It's tough.
Okay. I used to work in-house at a hospital, and this was my responsibility. So I'll tell you that HIPAA covers physicians and business associates. If you are not a physician or a business associate, HIPAA generally does not cover you. So if you're an attorney, that you're not bound by HIPAA. That's the short answer.
I think it's a good point, though, about this leads back to the conversation about disclosing medical issues, right? Sometimes I think we forget when when we're debtors counsel in particular, how in the weeds of our clients' lives we get when we're dealing with their, talking about their money, right? I mean, you know how much they're paying for prescriptions. You know what they pay for cigarettes each month. And if they're buying, you know, how much they pay for their dog food. I mean, you know way more about, like, this is an intimate thing about their life. And sometimes I forget about that. And I forget how easily we just talk about our clients' financial circumstances. I think we need to remember that. So we may not be bound by HIPAA disclosure, or that may not apply to the attorneys, but I think we need to make sure we're not callous about their medical issues. And that we really think about how the going through this process impacts them. I tell every single one of my clients that this is very personal to them. Before every 341, this is very personal to you. This is a very impersonal process. And the trustee most likely will not remember what you look like at the end of the day. And that's not a knock on the trustee who has, you know, 50 people or however many cases that day. It's just the circumstance, because they come in and they are so wound up, right? They're so wound up. They're so nervous. And you're like, this is nothing. It's like a 5 minute, it's not even 5 minutes sometimes, right? These hearings are so quick, but this is so personal to them. So we have to remember to provide some compassion in the process. You know, use their name instead of debtor sometimes. Treat them like, let them be informed about the process that they're going through, so that they can move through this and say, this was a tough time in my life, but now I am on the other side, and really get that fresh start. So with that,
when they're doing the budget, sometimes they'll come up with an extraordinarily large amount for medical expenses, and that opens up sometimes the discussion that you need to find out exactly why they are spending so much on medication, doctor's visits, counselors, psychologists, that type of thing, and then you get a better picture.
Absolutely. I mean, the prescriptions and medical treatment can be very expensive. Very expensive, and depending what's covered by their insurance. So those are legitimate expenses. When you're looking at whether someone should qualify for a Chapter 7 or a Chapter 13, if they might not want to disclose that they have all of these medical expenses. They may be embarrassed or worried about disclosing that, but that could make a huge difference in whether they have to go through a 5-year process or be in and out in 90 to 120 days, right? 120 days. Did anyone have any, we wanted to really open this up for anyone to share any stories. I will say, just as a caveat, that we all have had completely crazy clients, right? So I'm hoping we can come at this from more of a mental health, we had this situation, how to talk about it, and not a client, you know, listen to this crazy client that I had story. So
we had a client, husband and wife in 13, and he's courting the wife before we went into the meeting of creditors. When I asked about her husband's just really erratic behavior.
Hold on. Can everybody hear him? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a microphone. Can everybody hear him okay?
So,
yes, no, in the back?
Yeah. Chapter 13, okay. 341. I was informed by the wife of a couple when I asked, where is your husband? And she said, well, he had run downstairs to get something to eat. And I said, we're about to go in, et cetera. I said, what is going on with him? And she said, he's stoned. I said, what do you mean he's stoned? Well, he has a problem, and I wasn't aware of that. I don't know why I wasn't aware of that, but I wasn't aware of that before we went to 341. Thankfully, that morning, they had no tax returns. They had not turned in their tax returns to the trustees, so the matter didn't go forward anyway at the meeting of creditors.
It's the only time an attorney's ever said thankfully for them to show up without their tax returns. But
yeah, another technique.
Because I certainly have no medical knowledge or ability to assess it, but he was wired. And had we had to go forward, I don't know what I would have said or not said on the record. And granted, there are evidentiary issues that do or do not apply in 341. not sure what to do or when to disclose, if anything, if I'm aware of it. The case ended up being
so we're on the far side.
I'm speaking only for myself as a Chapter 7 trustee and not for everybody, but I will tell you that I've had that occasion and that it appeared in front of me, and I just said, let's adjourn this a different day, because I didn't feel like it was But at any rate, what I was going to tell everyone is if you've got a client with mental issues, call the trustee before you even tell them. Just tell them so that we're aware, because as Erin said, I got 64 cases. Just let me know.
I think that's a good point. And how would you respond, Karen, to if a debtor's counsel came up to you and said, like at the 341, hey, I think we need to adjourn this because my clients,
okay. Just like, my clients aren't adjourned. Can you speak up? Handle the situation as it arises.
I mean, that goes again, though, to one of our issues being bankruptcy attorneys, right, is that we financially and economically, now you got to come back another time, you got to communicate with them to get them there, and then they don't show, right? And it continues the case longer, but maybe that's better than having them say something, like, totally out of line on the record. Better for them, for sure. Anyone else? Oh, yeah.
I think that is a really good point. I've had a couple of clients that they presented okay, but they were actually deep in their psychosis and they had not been brought to the bottom. Other people brought them to me. One, he seemed okay, and then I saw him in the news and he dressed it, and there's an MI commitment, and seemed not go well. And another one, I begged the wife, please follow your husband. Something's not right, something's not right. And he robbed a couple eggs.
Right, and I think you want the case to be successful, right? You want to. There's definitely relief to someone who has anxiety over the process or depression or is going through a tough situation. Just getting through the process and having that debt gone is a huge relief under those circumstances. But at what point are you just the lawyer and you can only do what you can do?
You can't ignore some of them. There was a time that I had represented in the 13 a millionaire, I knew talking with them, it was like, well, why don't you liquidate your assets and pay your bills and fund the planning session? And he would not accept that type of logic because his assets, he said he wanted to retain.
And so we finally got to the point where I talked with some family member and saying, look, your dad really needs to go ahead and have a conservator appointed because he's not thinking rationally at all. And about 2 months later, the son refused to do it. And 2 months later, I'm watching the evening news, and he's not in a quite shootout with the police, but it was a stalemate where the police were viewing the video and the police car kept the lights on, and he's holed up in his building where his assets are, and it can be that stuff if you just say, oh, it'll take care of itself or something.
So I've heard a couple people mention kind of intuition or spidey senses kind of tingling that you just kind of knew, and it's real. So when that happens, you know, there usually is something going on there.
And that's the low threshold of suspicion, right?
Mm-hmm. Erica, I just want to, because I know we're about to wrap this up, I want to thank the ABI for having this particular subject matter discussed. It's, in my knowledge, it's the first time it's ever been brought up that the two concerns have ever been merged together. It's the first time. I look forward for more discussions, more thought being given to this, because mental illness is a major concern in everybody's household, everybody's family, some way, shape, or form. And I thank you for making me a part of this.
Oh, thank you.